Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for more than 43 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and exchange information, learn from each other, teach each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you all for coming back this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we're going to try and do it all over again. So with that in mind, let me drop for a second, and I will then give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me by email, that would be either for mailbag questions, questions that you would normally ask during the technical net, but you're not in radio distance, or if there's a topic that you would either like to present to the technical net or be part of a presentation, or just hear a discussion, topics, please let me know. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for TechNet puzzles. They're few and far between. They're very rare, preferably something that isn't easily Googleable, or even better than that. Occasionally I have found puzzles where if you Google them, you get the wrong answer. So with that in mind, if you come up with any, please let me know. Or if you want me to tag Paul, WS2N, about a NASA or space-related story that you saw and get his take, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Mine is, I'll give you two alternatives. One is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Another one that you could use is roy@limarktech.net. I offer a link page of all kinds of interesting links that I have collected over the last week. This week I have a nice little picture of the material that was returned from the Bennu asteroid samples, and a bunch of other interesting stories. So if you want to take a look at that, and it's up 24/7, you just type into your browser either roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net. That'll land you there. We have a chat room. It's been quiet for a month or two, but you never know. If you want to reach the chat room, you type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or alternatively chat.limarktech.net. We offer an audio stream of the technical net and the Glen Oaks repeater in general. I keep it active all week long. You want to hear the audio stream, you just type into your browser either technet.ac2gs.com or alternatively stream.limarktech.net. And I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So please check it out. Anyway, let me drop and I'll tell you what we got planned. Okay. We got a regular schedule set up for tonight. We'll ask for any questions or comments or topics for discussion. I would prefer if the first few are amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio net, but as you all know by now, hopefully, I'm open to discussing any aspect of science and technology as best I can. So as the night progresses, you're free to ask questions of that nature. So that's the plan. If the laws of physics continue and the repeater is behaving well and my shack is behaving well, we have Echolink and IRLP back. We didn't have it last week, so... And, of course, we have All-Star Link. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't hear me this way. Anyway, that's what we got tonight. So anyone out there with any questions or comments or topics for discussion, hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
W2BG, ham radio related.
Okay, Rich. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
C2 from SHO.
John recognized. Welcome back. Are you on IRLP?
No, my old 10-year-old or whatever IRLP node got tired of goofing with it, and the last time it acted up, I just decided to stick it on the shelf. I need to buy an All-Star node, but right now I'm using Transceive, a web app, to tie into the All-Star node.
Okay, very good. So you're on All-Star, I'm on All-Star. Good to hear you, nevertheless, one way or the other. Rich and John are on the list. Anyone else want to join them there? Hit that push to talk.
The problem is they're not a Quebec One uniform, John.
Unfortunately, you two doubled. So John Coe first, and then the second person.
Roger. King Bravo 2 Alpha. I'd like to know the website that will download the computer. I'd like to see you on the computer. Is that maybe pass that along when you're ready?
Sure. We have two addresses. You could look it up. You could either use technet.ac2g@.com, or an alternative address is stream.limarktech.net. Both of them will give you the audio stream of the technical net and the Glen Oaks repeater.
Can we go with the first one? You said test netting a little slow. I'm typing it as you talk.
Sure. It's technet dot, and my call sign, alphacharlie2golfsierra.com.
Okay, thank you, Roy. I appreciate that. .net and your call sign.
Yes, indeed. That's all you need. You type it in on your browser, and it should pop up a nice little audio player. You know, hit the little play button, and you should hear the audio stream. It's a little delayed, about 10 seconds, give or take, but it's good quality audio.
Okay, give me the last, I got Alpha AC2, give me the last of the other prefixes. I think I wrote it wrong.
Yes, it's Golf Sierra, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra.
Roger that, back in the control, thank you, Roger.
Okay, you're welcome, John. Now, the gentleman who doubled with John, who isn't John, can you give me your call sign and your name?
Well, it is John. This is Juliet Oscar November is the name, and call sign is November Quebec One Uniform. I do have a question about the commercial FM signal.
Okay, very good. So we got a whole bunch of Johns. That's good. So we'll get to you. You're third in line for tonight. So let's begin with Rich W2BZ. What's your question or your comment for tonight? Okay, we got Wesley in fourth place here. Very good.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody else who's listening. My question is about the difference between a one-to-one balun and an RF choke. Now, some people say they're the same things, but they aren't the same thing. And I have wound toroids with, let's say, five turns, and then you go across the toroid and up around the other side of it and wound another five turns. A lot of people do that to protect their RF, but that's not a one-to-one balun either. As far as I know, a balun of any kind uses a primary and a secondary winding, and let's say a 1-to-9 or a 1-to-49, you wind that with three wires, not just one wire, but with three wires. And that creates your primary and secondary. So that's the question. What's the difference between a one-to-one balun and an RF choke. Go ahead, boys.
Okay. Strictly speaking, a balun is an adapter to deal with the fact that one part of your line is balanced and one part is unbalanced. The unbalanced part usually is a coaxial transmission line because coaxial transmission lines are unbalanced transmission lines. Open wire, which is symmetrical, is a balanced transmission line. But I would think that if maybe 4% of hams use them, that's a lot. So, and the antenna can either be balanced or unbalanced. A dipole is a balanced antenna. An NFED is an unbalanced antenna. So the term balun is a contraction of balanced and unbalanced. People use it in a very sloppy way because most legitimate balanced to unbalanced balans are transformer balans. It not necessarily has to do with how many number of wires are wound. You can have a transformer balun with two wires. It's not uncommon to have them with three, but you can get away with two. And as long as the number of primary windings and secondary windings are identical, it's a one-to-one balun. The impedance going in is the same impedance going out. But it isolates the two sources from the imbalancement of going from unbalanced to balanced. Now, a lot of times people don't really need the transformer balun. What they all need is just some means to block the common mode reflections off of the antenna. If there's a mismatch of some kind between the transmission line antenna feeding point and the antenna, the energy is reflected back as a common mode, a current that radiates across your transmission line rather than your antenna, which we don't like. So we want to block it with something to block the common mode. You can use a one-to-one transformer balun to do that. You can also use a high impedance inductor. That's where wrapping a transmission line around a toroid comes in. It increases the inductive impedance of the outer shielding of the transmission line and blocks common mode reflections going down your transmission line and into your shack. So both RF chokes and one-to-one transformer balans can serve the same purpose, and because of that, the definitions get mashed up, and almost everyone calls an RF choke a one-to-one balun. It's a little laziness on everyone's part, but it's a common practice.
So you said that a balun can be wound with two wires or three wires. I've never seen a balun wound with two wires, only three wires. And that's because you need two wires coming off one end and three wires coming off the other end, one going to ground on each side. So I've never seen them wound with two wires. But what you're saying is they act similarly. A one-to-one balun is the same thing as an RF choke, or does the same thing as an RF choke. Is that what you're saying?
Depending upon the design, yes. I mean, there are flaky transformer balans that don't act as a great common mode isolator. It depends. There's a lot of curious designs for balans. I bought a book, a gentleman who I think became a silent key 10, 15 years ago, Cevic, did a lot of work on balun designs, and they're very convoluted. The drawings of how they're wired together kind of can give people mild migraines. So there's a lot of different ways to wire up a one-to-one toroidal balance. Some of them, as I said, will isolate the common mode and some of them won't. So unfortunately, sometimes you end up needing to have an RF choke after a balance.
So you're saying that an RF, like a balance, a 1 to 49 balance, which people use with long wires, that doesn't also do away with common mode?
Well, again, it sort of depends upon how it's designed. The only thing that makes a 49-to-1 balun a 49-to-1 balun is the primary and the secondary windings differ by a ratio of 7-to-1. So 7 squared is 49. So that's what gives you the impedance transformation ratios. But the way that you wire together something that has a primary, secondary with a 7-to-1 ratio will determine whether it itself is a good isolator for common mode or not. So there are 49-to-1s that block common mode, and there are 49-to-1s that don't. Most of the 49-to-1s that I'm aware of that are used for NFEDs do not block common mode, because you want a degree of common mode going through it, because most people tend not to use a grounding wire as a counterpoise. They use their transmission lines as a counterpoise. So what they usually do is put a 49-to-1 at the end of an NFED wire, and then at some length of the transmission line is choked later on with an RF choke. So that length prior to the RF choke is operating as a counterpoise for that NFET.
So that's the way I'm doing it. But on 10 meters, I still get a tremendous amount of RF in the shack, which distorts the audio. So, but that's the way I'm doing it. I have two toroids wound on the coax going into the 49-to-1, and it still doesn't do away with the RF, only on 10 meters. So don't know what's up with that. All right, I think I have it, except for the fact that how does a true 1-to-1 balun wound with a primary and a secondary, how does that do the same thing as winding coax around a toroid?
It can isolate the common mode. The common mode is riding down your coax cable on the outer aspect of the shield. If you are wiring up the transformer so as to isolate the common mode, it'll do that. It's sort of the same basic principle of an isolation transformer that a lot of people will use if they're working on a piece of equipment and it has a ground and it's going to screw up their test equipment. They then put the test equipment on an isolation power transformer, and so the ground is not connected to the same ground as the test equipment, and you don't get ground pulls and such. So it's, as long as you don't kind of crosswire and play games with the 1-to-1, you can build a 1-to-1 transformer isolation balun that will block common mode currents from jumping over from the antenna's transmission line to the other side of the balun.
Would you say a true 1-to-1 will block? I'm trying to get rid of this RF on 10 meters on my long wire. Would you say that a true 1-to-1 balun, which has a true secondary and a primary, will help with getting, you know, dealing with RF better than just a toroid wound, you know, with coax on the, you know, with the transmission line, you know, would you say that one is more preferable over the other?
Not necessarily. I mean, you might get a more attenuation with a one-to-one isolation ballon, but probably all you really need is another RF choke. I realize that you have basically two RF chokes on your NFED, but apparently the amount of common mode current that's going, getting reflected back in the 10-meter mode is a lot more. RF chokes are not kind of binary things. They're attenuators. So depending upon the impedance of each individual RF choke, they might, you know, drop your common mode current, 70-60%. So, and the next one will drop what's left 60%, and the next one will drop what's left after that 60%. So the easiest, simplest thing to do if you're having problems with 10 meters is just set up another RF choke after the first two. Hopefully the additional attenuation will suffice. You might need a fourth, or you might need more windings on the RF chokes that you've already started to use. So there are, there's a bunch of different ways of going about it, but probably all you need is just another RF choke in series with the first two. Yeah, I heard someone in the distance. The signal is very, very low. You want to yell into the microphone?
Yes, kilowatt zero, bravo, bravo.
Yes, kilowatt zero, bravo, bravo. What do you got to say?
Palomar Industries makes a noise choke specific for RF and HF. It has a pretty, I can't remember the CD or the simulation, but it's very high for noise. I have one. I've never had to use it for anything, but I know that they make such a thing. A specialized noise reduction filter, I think it's called. It's probably the same thing as a choke, but it might have a higher attenuation as you would say.
Yeah, if you could raise your amplitude higher, I could make out your words, but they're very, very whispery. Yeah, I own the same exact thing. They're just glorified RF chokes. They sell a lot of ferrites, and they use them and seal them in boxes. I have a rather strong Palomar RF choke coming that I put right in the window as the coax cable enters my home. I have a big RF choke at the antenna feed point of my antennas, but I also have one that sits right outside my window that diminishes the signal. And just to be on the safe side, I have another smaller version that they sell that goes right into the antenna input of my transceiver.
K0BD radio check.
Yeah, I hear you well.
All right, thanks. I want to get back to the question. I just wanted to check. I raised my mic gain.
Yeah, you're a good 10 dB louder than you were earlier. It's much easier to listen. But yeah, I like them. They might be a little overpriced, but they're really aggressive as far as supplying a common mode impedance to the common mode signal. So I had a little problem with RF getting into the shack, and I put one of the big boxes outside the window, and it cleaned it up really nicely.
NY50S, radio check sounds good here in East Meadow.
Okay, very good. NY50S. What's your first name, sir?
Fred.
Okay, very good, Fred. You're sounding good here as well. So let's get back to Rich. Is the question answered? Do you have any other questions related to that? It gets a little confusing because I understand that, strictly speaking, there's not much of a case to really say that a inductor, a high impedance inductor, balances two lines, but it solves the problem that unbalanced lines provoke. So I guess that's where the two terms kind of merged and melded together.
No, well, it answers, I'll take your suggestion. I'm going to put a third toroid in and see if that doesn't help with the 10-meter RF problem. So I'll give that a try. You know, it's a little hard to know whether one should wind them, you know, 5 to 4 on the other side, or 5 to 5, you know, 5 windings, and you go across the toroid, you go the opposite direction and wind another 5 or 4. I've never been able to find, you know, what the optimal windings are. So I'll just try another one and see what happens. But and I'll report back, Roy. Thanks a lot. WTPG.
Okay, very well. AC2GS here. It doesn't really matter what direction you wind them in. It matters how many times you wind them. The beauty of windings in a toroid are that it's the attenuation factor, the resulting impedance from the windings multiply each other, as opposed to if you just put a row of chokes next to each other on a coax cable, then it's just additive. So in other words, if you, say, put 3 clamps on a coax cable versus 1 clamp, you'll get 3 times the impedance, whereas if you take a toroid and loop your transmission line once versus 3 times, the 3 times will give you 9 times the impedance benefit. So as many coils as you could wind onto the toroid without screwing up the architecture of the transmission line. You don't want to make too many sharp turns because the center core should be in the center. It shouldn't work its way to the edges if you're forcing too tight an angle on it. But the more loops that you make on a toroid, the more impedance it has and the more isolation it demonstrates.
Okay, I'll fit as many as I can. And no, they're not tight turns. You can't really do that with coax around the toroid. You can't make them so tight. So it's like they have a 90-degree angle bend on them. Nothing like that. So, okay, I'll give it a try and I'll report that.
Okay, very good.
PhD?
Yes, Jim.
Good evening. This is Jim, KD2VHD. Two thoughts and a follow-up question. The antenna we're speaking of, is it possible that the long wire is not a compatible length with that band of 10 meters? Maybe that could be adjusted to make things happier? That's one thing. And something I've learned recently that you can verify or not, I'm not certain of it, is that the way that you wind the toroid for a choke is more dependent on how mechanically you want the choke to function, you know, as far as you want the in and the out to be on the same side of the coil or opposite sides, depending on your mechanical circumstances. So I'll throw them out for consideration.
Yeah, the maneuver where you cut across the middle of the toroid and then reverse the direction is just to make the two wires on either side, I think, of the toroid, so that you have less problems with things arcing and such. So it's more a mechanical and aesthetic kind of sensibility. You know, they don't really care as far electrically if they're going clockwise or counterclockwise. It's the number of loops. And you're correct in that probably one of the problems is at 10 meters, the resonance of the end fed is not really good, and so it's reflecting more down the transmission line. The problem, though, is if you fix the problem for 10 meters, you'll probably develop a problem on other meters, you know, on other bands. So if your problem is not inherently that you're not picking up if you're picking up a decent signal on 10, but you're troubled by the common mode reflections, you're probably best to deal just with the common mode reflections rather than modify the antenna and then have to deal with the repercussions on the other bands.
Sounds good from my point.
Yeah, yeah. You try not to fix things that aren't broken. That's my philosophy. Some people just want perfection, and, you know, God bless them, but it's probably the road to insanity eventually.
If that antenna is cut, it would be easier to actually put up a 10-meter dipole independently than to wind another toroid.
Well, yeah, that's an option, but it sort of depends. If you happen to have a drawer full of toroids like I do, it's probably easier to just wind another toroid.
Agreed. I have a related question to Anand, so you can put that in at the appropriate place. Back to that.
Okay, I'll put you down there, and we'll get you here. Thank you, Rich. Thank you for participating. Next on our list for tonight is John, KC2SHO. What's your question for tonight, John?
Yeah, Roy, good evening to you, everyone else on the net. I guess in my absence, I might be asking about something that's already been discussed, but if you remember, on one of the last times I was on the net, we were talking about the light flingers. I was just wondering if there was any more about that, and it doesn't have to be long, just a yes or a no, and maybe a quick synopsis if you want, or we could talk about it another time. But anyway, since I haven't been around, I was just kind of curious if that has been discussed more and there was any more understanding or talk about it. That's really all I have just so far this evening. EC2, GF from PC2, that's the show.
Okay, very good, John. We really haven't had that much conversation. It's really esoteric, and I've been trying to get around paywalls. Some people have been trying to help me. They sent me articles on how to get around paywalls, but these particular journal articles are just ungettable at this point. You know, maybe at some point or another. I'm looking for the technical journal articles of the people at Los Alamos published rather than the public relations material. And for those people who missed our conversation a couple of months ago, there's a technology that Los Alamos Labs have pioneered called light slingers, which are very, very unusual antennas. We are quite usual to standing wave antennas that use currents on conductors to produce radio waves. Light slingers are completely different. Light slingers are basically glorified capacitors in which the dielectric material between the two plates produce the RF waves. So you induce a current on either end of a dielectric insulating material, and you polarize the material in the dielectric. It's, you know, one portion is positive, the other is negative, and they align according to external charges. And by moving those charges back and forth, you get the dielectric itself, not the conductor, to emit radio waves. This allows you to pack them very tight. You don't need standing wave antennas, so they don't have to be resonant. And you can use multiples at one time, and you can adjust different phase angles for different capacitors. So you could make it highly directional, and you can pack it into any shape or form that you would want to, since it doesn't have to be a quarter wave or a half wave of conducting material. So it's a fascinating type of antenna that's probably very well suited for cell towers. The cell towers like to pack a lot of different transmissions on close frequencies, and in the case of light slingers, it's theoretically possible that you can send two completely different signals with the same frequency on antennas out in opposite directions, and you won't have much in the way of interference. So it's probably something that might revolutionize cell towers. I don't think hams are going to have light slingers in the near future, but it may make life a little bit better for your cell phone conductivity. Any response, John?
Sorry, since I'm using the web transceiver, I was on the other side of the room, and also takes a minute sometimes to alt-tab back to the active window. No other questions. Again, I was just curious if anything had transpired in my absence. That's really all. But thank you for the added information. Maybe I can ask around here and find something that I'd be allowed to pass on. I'll see what I can do.
AC2GS. Yeah, I'd appreciate it, John. And any assistance in, there must be guys who cut and paste the journal articles somewhere or other that, they wouldn't mind passing on. It's not like I'm making any money off of this. In point of fact, I'll probably just suffer a mild migraine trying to wrap my brain around it. But, I am fascinated by it and more than willing to kind of pass what little I can understand along to the rest of the guys here.
Yeah, real good, Roy. It's still something I have a little bit of trouble wrapping my head around. But we'll see what we can find and what I'm allowed to pass on. Real good. I'll let you get back to the net, and thanks again. And as always, enjoying the net. Look forward to hearing what else we have this evening. Don't know that I'll always be around the computer, and since I don't have a radio, that means I have to be right here to participate and listen. But we'll see what happens. I may wander in and out as we get the family to bed here. 73, and all the best. AC2GS and KC2SHO.
Okay, very good, John. Always a pleasure to chat with you. And I hope in future episodes of the Technical Net, you bring us some other interesting little tidbits from those guys at Los Alamos. And thank you for participating, as always. Now on to the next, John, NQ1U. You have a question or a topic about commercial FM?
Yeah, thanks. This is NQ1U. You mentioned migraines a couple of times, and this is a migraine-inducing question. This is probably too serious. Take a standard dipole, simple dipole antenna for an FM band, commercial band. And I understand the problems of multipath and line of sight, attenuation, that sort of stuff. Is it really worth any work to try to cut an FM antenna for one particular frequency, one particular commercial station versus the broadband type that's used all the time? We're talking dipoles only. I know that we can get jaggy, but is it a ridiculous waste of time to cut a commercial FM dipole for one station?
Well, in my humble opinion, the answer would be yes, for one big reason. Dick K2RIW, may rest in peace, used to say this repeatedly, that transmitters are fidgety creatures. If you don't have the proper impedance that they were designed for, they will give you nothing but trouble. But receivers are blissfully disinterested. You could have the most non-resonant piece of wire out there, and they'll do a decent job. So it's far less important to have a resonant antenna for a receiver than for a transmitter. The amount of energy required by the low-noise, high-gain amplification chain of receivers require microvolts of energy. And so to kind of go through a lot of trouble for the sake of a repeater, I mean, if it is resonant, the signal will be a little bit stronger. And since FM, most of the noise is built into the machinery, your signal-to-noise ratio will improve. you don't get as much bang for the buck, in my opinion. So, you know, unless you're really, really interested in one broadcasting station that's very, very far away and very difficult to receive, I wouldn't waste much time in the way of building a dipole resonant specifically for that frequency.
Okay, great answer. I understand. Probably won't. Thanks very much. This is NQ, 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of notice that that's generally the practice when it comes to all the receivers, television receivers, FM receivers, AM receivers. No one has ever in the history of any of this really promoted specific frequencies. They've mentioned bands. Obviously, if you are trying to get UHF and VHF TV channels in the good old days, you needed to have the additional UHF-VHF arrays. But in generally speaking, receiving antennas are, you know, you don't have to worry too much about them. Put them in the general right direction. You know, make sure that there's no kind of Faraday cage surrounding them, and let them loose. And for the most part, they'll do what's right. You know, transmitting antennas, that's where the trouble comes.
Okay, makes sense. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you for participating tonight. Next on our list is Jim. Jim, what's your question or comment for tonight?
So the Valen conversation made me think of it, and as I've been fiddling around with my off-center dipole stuff, I've come to the realization that what seems to be recommended for this situation of an off-center dipole is a 4-to-1 unun and also a choke. Problem is, finding a 4-to-1 on either in a design or a product seems to be quite difficult, and it's like looking for unobtainium or hen's teeth. Any thoughts on that matter?
Okay, well, I would say you're looking in the wrong places, because I probably have a 4-to-1 maybe about 10 feet away from me in a drawer. They're not that difficult. They're basically a 2-to-1 transformer winding gives you a 4-to-1 impedance. They're available. You can get them certainly low power. I think it's LDG sells a bunch of relatively low power balans, and one of them I'm sure is a 4-to-1 because I own it. But there are other 4-to-1 balans out there. It's not as flashy as 1-to-1 and 9-to-1. And 48-to-1 and 68-to-1, but they're out there.
I was specifically referring to an un-un, because if I understand it correctly, and this may be splitting hairs in this, I don't know, but a coax line feeding an off-center dipole is an unbalanced line feeding an unbalanced antenna, so we should really get an un-un. Or is this just disregarded because doesn't make much difference?
Yeah, it's pretty much disregarded. So you could probably easily get away. Matter of fact, the worst that would happen by the fact of it not being an un-un being a balun is you'll get some common mode reflection. And what you know, you're already planning to put an RF choke there. So, again, the problem is that again, although un-uns really don't make a lot of sense to me, they're kind of like bow-bows, which thankfully no one uses that term because, you know, theoretically other than the just transforming impedance, you don't need any kind of circuit tricks because you're connecting an unbalanced to an unbalanced, which shouldn't give you a problem. So I wouldn't really be troubled by not having something designated as an un-un. If the only thing you can find is a 4-to-1 balun, go with the 4-to-1 balun and just use the RF choke. It should work.
Okay, I think I get what the common answer is. Would you mind if I follow it up with a mechanical analogy and tell me if I'm just thinking wrong?
Okay, I hope it's not a plumbing one, but let her rip.
No, it's a boating one. I've been trying to understand this thing about balanced and unbalanced and a coax line with its, you know, the semiconductor transmitting the signal and the return path on the inside of the coax. And that sneaky little common mode of current returning on the outside of the coax and all that stuff. And the analogy that comes to mind is a rowboat. And it seems to me that, that as the antenna is looking at the signal coming from the coax, it almost sees a rowboat rowing with one oar. And the they can see two oars rowing and equalize that signal to both halves of the antenna. So it's perhaps a far fetched analogy, but am I misunderstanding something about the whole process?
Not particularly. I mean, analogies are never perfect, but yours is a decent one. You know, I would use the seesaw version that, you know. A seesaw with only one end isn't a heck of a good seesaw type of thing. So, although, you know, physics sort of likes some degree of balance, you can introduce an unbalanced aspect, but there's a virtual balance to it. A quarter wave a vertical antenna with ground planes is basically using a virtual image of the other dipole in the opposite direction. It's virtual and it's made from the radials, but as far as the physics is involved, it acts sort of like a center-fed dipole, which is preferable to physics. So, yeah, it's a reasonable analogy, I think.
So I'll put in the ballot and continue to study the topic for academic reasons, but for practical reasons, I'm chasing a puff in the wind.
Yep.
Well, thank you. Back to that, unless there's any other comments.
ZDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I just wanted to recommend a book. It's a ARRL publication, Transmission Line Transformers by Jerry Sevick, W2FMI. You can get it through the ARRL publications. It's got a nice readable section on the whole thing of these ununs and balans and stuff like that. It's pretty readable because it is a ARRL publication. Again, that's Transmission Line Transformers by Jerry Sevick, W2FMI. Okay.
Yeah, thanks, John. I mentioned that earlier. I didn't have the title. I just vaguely remembered Sevick. He's been dead for about 12, 13 years, I think. It's a nice readable book. It really doesn't go into theory much as far as I can recall. And a lot of times, he doesn't really explain the designs. He just kind of presents them as something he tinkered with and it works. So it's very light in theory, so that's a good point for some people. I would prefer a little bit more theory, but it's just kind of presented as matter of fact. But it's an interesting book to have. It's not a very thick book, and there's no math at all as far as I can recollect.
Yeah, that's what's nice about it. You won't get one of those nosebleed sessions where they load you down with del dot this and del dot that and stuff like that there. So it's a nice readable book.
Yeah, I'll give you that. It's kind of difficult to follow the circuit paths because it's some of them are schematics, others are more kind of open end drawings of wires twisting around the toroid and such. So it's an interesting book to read, and probably you could get through the entire book in a day and a half. Again, you don't have to sit there and try and make sense out of theory, because he doesn't really present much theory.
Well, I thank you. I'll look into that.
Okie doke. Thank you, John. And thank you, of course, as always, Jim, for participating tonight. I assume Wesley is going to have a non-amateur question. Is that going to be the nature of tonight's presentation, Wesley?
Good.
Okay, so with that in mind, let me just ask the rest of the people out there if anyone has an amateur radio-related question that we can do before the non-amateur radio-related question, then please hit that push to talk. Going, I guess. Okay, Wesley, what do you got to tell us tonight?
Not something. Las Vegas, there was a show, periodic, once per year, called Consumer Electronics, and they presented, if you're interested in things, but at the same time, something, some of interesting things in science. So on that show, there was a robot that imitates handwriting as if it was your own, including check sign. That's by the company handwritten.com. www.handwryten.com. So it was really eye catching, and let's see that. And amazing. So all you have to do is repeat two letters. How you write them. So let's say, how do you write double O? How do you write W? And after 3 minutes, it is almost impossible for the professional to find out the difference between your own writing and the writing of the robot. So that's kind of scary from one hand. Any comments, and which you?
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I certainly have a comment. We were talking about the Consumer Electronics Show last Sunday night after it ended, and the week earlier I was doing some predictions about high-nit monitors being displayed at the Consumer Electronics Show. I mean, this is the nature of our future. You can't believe anything you see or hear. The simulations, the audio simulations of voices is getting better and better. The ability to generate a video that never really took place is getting better and better. So why not handwriting? There have been artificial handwriting machines, mechanical in nature, for more than 100 years. I think the White House had one of those machines, and they would just kind of, voters get handwritten assigned notes from presidents back in the old days via a mechanical device. But I realize that those devices tend to replicate identically. So if you had one copy of the mechanical writing, you could figure out that it was generated that way if you saw it again. So, this is just our future. You can't trust anything anymore. And the people are already using that as an excuse that, obviously things that they did say that were taped, where you have audio tape, the guy's now just going to say that, that's all artificial intelligence nonsense. I never said anything like that. I'm an angel. So, that's our future. That's the brave new world.
Thank you very much. That's so funny. The second thing for me is childishly uses this word properly. Child uses it.
How should I say it?
Well, it sort of depends on what you're trying to say. I mean, if you acted in a childish manner, childishly is a reasonable word. It just depends what the next few words are going to be.
Okay, so I was not caught by a revelation, but I was caught by the form it was written. A new study of researchers at MIT has revealed surprising discovery. Okay. Why do we need MIT to that? But anyhow, we learn at schools that water evaporates when it gets hot. The heat energy makes the water molecules near the surface break free from the liquid and escape into the air as gas or water vapor. But light can triple the evaporation rate of the water. And that's an MIT study. So I found it easy, but I would appreciate your comment afterwards.
Light is electromagnetic energy. Electromagnetic energy is absorbed by matter, and the average kinetic energy, otherwise known as temperature, goes up. Temperature goes up, evaporation goes up. So that's kind of common sense. You put a lot of lights on something, and they heat up. And when you heat the surface up, you get evaporation more than if you cool it down. So, I don't know. That doesn't really strike me as unusual. It's kind of a common sense aspect of physics, as far as I can say.
Comment.
Yes, please, comment.
I only saw the head to this, so I haven't read deeply about it, but what I want to know is, do you think there's a way that this, well, it's quote-unquote finding, could improve the efficiency of, let's say, an evaporative cooler? Us in the Southwest, us curious minds, where evaporative cooling is much more useful, I want to know.
Well, evaporative cooling is, you know, I mean, the most obvious example is the very cheap Chinese knockoff, usually called a swamp fan. It basically is a small pool of water and a fan, and if you're fortunate to be living in a hot environment that's very dry, like a desert, the evaporation energy is dissipated from the environment. The phase change going from liquid to gaseous takes the energy as heat out of the system, and it cools you. Evaporative cooling is very useful in very low humidity desert-like environments. If you took the same type of equipment to, say, Florida in the middle of the summer, you would get no benefit whatsoever because the amount of evaporative cooling under those circumstances of the high swamp-like humidity would be negligible. So evaporative cooling is an interesting technology that tend to be oversold in those little swamp fans that Chinese companies offer to sell you miraculously for you know, $15-$20. Because how much does some plastic and a fan and a little pad of absorbent cotton cost?
Well, even the $3,000 unit on my roof seems widely overpriced, but that's another discussion.
Yeah, well, you know, what can I tell you? I mean, companies have to make their profits usually, you know, multiple times their profits. And where was it manufactured? What is it, American manufactured, or is it the European?
You know, I'd have to look. I forget some brand now, but I assume it's American.
Okay, well, someone has to pay those labor bills and such. It's rather expensive to manufacture things in the United States, which is unfortunately why it all kind of moved to other places. Some things have moved down to Mexico. Others have moved to China. Lately, they've been re-moving away from China into the rest of South Asia.